Welcome to Weird Games and Weirder People, a podcast about role-playing games and the weird, wonderful people behind them.
Hello, wonderful weirdos, this is Diogo Nogueira and today's guest is the amazing Luke Gearing. He's an amazing writer, adventure creator and game designer, even though he has a little bit of a problem with this term. But before we get into that, I would like to do a few announcements. I will be at Game On Expo on Phoenix, Arizona from March 15th to 17th, and I will be on Gary Cohn on Lake Geneva, Wisconsin from March 23rd to 25th. Also, please subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen to your podcast so you get updates when we release new episodes. And please leave us a review, share with your friends, with your family, with people that like games. And please support the show too. Look on the show notes to see how you can pay us a coffee at Ko-Fi or buy one of my books to keep the show going. And I will do what I can here to keep the show going too. But getting back to Luke Gearing, we talk about how he has been doing game stuff for years and years, and now he's tackling bigger and bigger projects, more ambitious projects. We talked about how he objects the term game designer and see himself more as a writer, a fictional writer, someone who creates situations. He's really into writing more adventures and setting instead of systems. We talk about that. We talk about how he doesn't. He's not very interested in systems and in different games, and more about settings and stories and situations. We talk about his love for music, his love for noise. We talk about plans. We exchange many wisdom, facts and insights that we share about gaming, about life in general. It was a fantastic chat. It was really, really enriching. I hope you like it as much as I did. So let's get weird with Luke Gearing. Hello, Luke. Welcome to Weird Games and Weirder People. I'm very happy to have you here. I'm excited to talk about Swivers and talk about your work in the RPG, which is a really big reference to me. So how have you been, Luke?
Yeah, good. And thank you for saying that. It's very kind of you to say. And thank you for having me on as well. I'm excited to do it.
Yeah, well, first of all, how do I say your last name? Is Luke Gearing?
Gearing,
is that
yeah,
right?
Gearing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So, Luke Gearing, it's an honor to have you here. Maybe the wonderful weirdos who listen to the show might not know who you are and all the amazing things that you do. So, if you can you say who is Luke Gearing, what is that you do? And if you can, just share a small detail about yourself, maybe the way you wake up in the morning, what is that you do, or the way you pour your coffee, or anything like this.
Sure. So I'm Luke, and I usually just say writer. A lot of people use the term game designer, but maybe we'll get into that one later. So I've been doing stuff for, it must be around a decade now, just starting with a little blog and kind of doing bigger and bigger projects as time's gone on. So like some of the more recent stuff, some of the stuff with Mothership, obviously, some of the big ones, Wolves as well at the moment, quite a lot for Troika with Dan Sell, as well as Fever Swamp was like the first like book. So in terms of the really quotidian stuff you want to know, like, I guess as soon as I wake up, first things first, I've got to take the dog for a walk, because my wife gets up a lot earlier than I do, so I do the dog. And for coffee, I use a cafetiere. I always have done.
You talk about, you know, being a writer, and then you talk about game design, and you're gonna talk about it later. Do you see a big difference in that? Do you see yourself as both as a writer and a game designer, or is this like the way you talk? It seems like it's kind of something people threw at you and you see more as a writer, or am I reading too much into it?
I mean, some of it's a little tongue-in-cheek, but I do think, like, for me, it's, you know, it's primarily a written form of communication. So, like, for me, that's the primary thing I'm trying to always, like, kind of focus on and improve on is the writing aspect. Like, it's not to say game design's bad, obviously, or anything like that. It's just, like, especially because, like, generally my preferences run to more towards doing adventures as well. Like, the kind of more systemic stuff is, like, usually somewhat less interesting to me. So, for me, focusing on the idea of it being, like, a a written thing, like a book that you read, that's like important. Like for me, if I'm reading someone else's adventure or like book, like system book or whatever, like if it's boring to read, I'm very likely to just put it down and never think about it again. And there's some stuff that kind of breaks that, but it's the quality of the writing is like really top priority for me in terms of the work I put out and what I like to read and use subsequently.
Yeah, that's true. And you have a really great way with words, like those books you wrote about treasure and monsters that are kind of poetic and, you know, a game book too are fascinating and for me, genius. I wish I could write that well. And it is fantastic. I realize that you write a lot of adventures, but is Swivers the first game in like you're designing, or have you ever designed games before that?
So
entire games, I mean.
Swivers like started like 5 or 6 years ago. Like it technically predates Blades in the Dark by like a couple of months, which is always fun because people always obviously compare it to that. What would it be, like a crime game? But I think apart from like some scribbles when I was like very, very young before I was sort of doing this seriously, it's the first time I was like sitting down and kind of making something whole cloth. So yeah, I guess it would be the first one, but like whilst it's been kind of in pre-publication, I've done a few other like smaller things, but they tend to be quite sort of short, sharp and focused. Like there's never been anything quite so larger Swivers. Like Wolves has a lot of content, but the actual rules themselves are super light. There was like Violence, but that's almost more of like proving a point than anything else in some ways, where it's just like here's the rules for combat, everything else just talk to your players, and that's kind of like the point. I think those are like the main ones that like stick out in my mind. There's like a couple, but like definitely more adventures and systems at this point, which is definitely the way I want to keep it.
Oh yeah,
because I think like
it's actually what I want to try to do. I always write a lot of systems, and I never thought I would write good adventures. And when one adventure I wrote, people actually liked it, and somehow I won an award for it, and I thought, yeah, I want to try writing more adventures, because it is, like you said, like rooms. For me, it's kind of fun because it plays with how the games can work and creates more story and narrative. I like to play with games that the games themselves help you create more interest in and, you know, twists in the games. But, you know, working with setting and adventures and creating this kind of fiction and words that the players can play with to create their own words. It's kind of a system of symbols in a way. Maybe the rune systems give you the tools and the bolts and the things that makes things move. But the ingredients to make this meaningful and, you know, it's all about the adventure and the setting. And I think you excel in that, like few people do. So, yeah. It's fun to see also you creating this together with a game system, and I'm curious to see how that develops. So I'm excited about that.
Yeah,
go ahead.
The divide is like it's really interesting because, like you say, I think there's definitely something to the idea of like the system does like some stuff for you, but it's kind of like it's non-specific. Even if it's for like a specific setting, it's like you can look at a system and you can imagine all the stuff you might be able to do with it, whereas an adventure is kind of like it's like a concrete substantiation of those ideas, which like is a lot scarier to write, because then it's if the adventure's bad, then you made a bad adventure, whereas like a system just kind of implies a bunch of stuff, so it's kind of less. It's more difficult to point at something and say, oh, this wasn't good, or this wasn't a great idea, or whatever. But I think that's also part of what makes it worth doing, is that it's like it's more difficult and more specific, and you have to kind of own it. Like you have to just be like, yep, like, this is the thing.
Yeah,
which is like a good thing. Like ultimately, it just does make it more intimidating, I think, which is why a lot of people shy away from them a bit more.
Yeah, I think that's something to do. That I think that designing traditional role-playing games, like you said, like at the game system, you have a really great adventures. I think it's kind of easier because you can count on the group and the GM to run the game, so they will put stuff in for you, so it's kind of incomplete. But an adventure, no, you have to have everything there for them to play and find out what happens. So It you have to be way more thoughtful and way more concise and tie things in a way that sometimes you don't need to when you're just designing a game system or maybe an adventure generator. So yeah, like in solo games, you have to make everything work and produce a result instead of counting on someone else to do it for you. Yeah,
you can't kind of rely on the GM as like a shortcut for the game being good, because ultimately the thing that decides how good any game is the players at the table, right? So yeah. I think system design stuff can really heavily lean on that. Like there's still stuff that's like good where I can look at something and go, impressive, like this is a good generator or whatever, but like a good generator is never going to excite me as much as like a really good adventure. Like the adventure's like, oh, this is like a thing, I can just go play it, great, done, perfect. Which is kind of what I like to provide as well. Like, something you can actually just use at your table.
You mentioned working on Swivers for a few years. Has the game changed a lot since then? And if it did, what motivated you to change the game as you developed it?
So way back when it started as just like a slight BX hack, which... Weirdly, it all started with Stars Without Number, because I was running that for some friends, and I realized that the way, because even though it's like, so Stars Without Number, sci-fi setting, but you still have like the BX chassis where like you gain hit dice and levels and whatever, and I was like, that doesn't feel right. And I was like, well, why does it feel right for fantasy? And I was like, well, it's just genre familiarity, so what if you didn't gain hit points like in that way? What if you didn't gain hit dice? What if it was like kind of set at the beginning? Very limited growth, and then it kind of grew out of there where I was just like, okay, like what can I like streamline away, what can I add that I think is cool? So it started, what I say, way back when as a simple reduction and streamlining of BX, and it kind of was like, oh, like dying in a tomb, like that's kind of like the thing that's really fun, because I was really into a lot of the Appendix N like classic literature at that point, so I was like really into Clark Ashton Smith, and there's a couple of them where like, as Swivers started named, like people just die in a tomb and that's kind of the story, which are really good fun, they're great. So that kind of grew, and then it was like kind of as the setting developed through the generation of like a bunch of tables basically, so you can kind of roll up your own idea of what this city looks like, district by district, and kind of, so I was always finding, especially back then, with something that large, if you make it yourself as a GM, you remember more of it. Whereas like a big city like that, kind of remembering that from a book is a lot of work. So it's like, just kind of give them the generators and let them make it themselves. So that was good. Then we kind of got the agreement to kind of publish it. And then for various reasons, things slowed down production wise, but that kind of did give me more time to refine it. So as my tastes grew, it kind of diverged further and further away from its kind of BX roots, to the point now where, apart from the fact there's hit points, it's basically unrecognizable, probably. Like, just like a lot of changes, like armor's much less of a big deal, so like your kind of defense is like based on what weapon you have, because if you've got a long weapon, it's harder to get close to you. And like, nice. For something like D&D, which is a bit more zoomed out, more abstracted, that makes perfect sense, but for this, it's like really short, sharp fights where you can gear a little bit more granular.
Far farting reminds we weren't wearing like lots of armor, so it makes perfect sense. Like,
yeah. And like, and if the players do go that route, then obviously that's like a cool and interesting thing where they're kind of twisting the setting a lot, or like they've done a lot of work to get a bunch of armor, so it's like, that's cool, that's fun. as well as like a lot of kind of taking the bits and pieces from like other games. Like I was really into Warhammer Fantasy for a while, so like the way death and dismemberment works, kind of super inspired by that. So it's kind of, in some ways, it's like a big grab bag of just stuff I've seen other people do that I've really enjoyed, as well as kind of trying to come up with, or just kind of not even coming up with on purpose, but kind of just like finding out about this setting as I was working on it, like, oh, like this is a thing that exists, that's a thing that exists, let's kind of go on from there.
Yeah, nice. Since we're talking about this and like inspirations you drew from, something that I always ask people who come here is that if they can identify maybe any area or region of inspiration that you see yourself constantly drawing upon. I know as artists and writers and game designers, we are always drawing anything that happens to us, like our daily lives, things we are interested in at the moment. But I, for example, draw a lot from the things that I enjoyed in my childhood, like comics, movies, and, you know, cartoons. Do you identify anything like this for yourself? It could be like a period of life, or like when this kind of genre of fiction or anything like this that you see yourself constantly drawing from for inspiration?
I can't think of like a specific period, because like I think one thing that I do with a lot of my games, there's a focus on like the physical like geography, like on a lot of the stuff I've worked on, and some of that's like the nature of adventures, they're like in the location. But like one thing I'm always like, the first thing I want to do is like have a map that I can point at and be like, this kind of describes what this place is like, and then focus on like being in the place. Because I think we did, when I was growing up, we did a lot of like travel around the UK, more than like foreign holidays, so there was kind of a lot of like sense of different place, as well as the sense of like history in each place, because obviously like the UK is full of ruins, and it's like, oh, this one's Roman, this one's, you know, this one's from the medieval period, this one's like a manor house that's from the 1800s but it's been like refurbished or whatever. And it's kind of, there's like these layers of history that I think is really interesting. So I think that's kind of represented a lot. Like one thing I've heard a lot of people say is there's a sense of like history and like kind of
like a real place,
history and place being, yeah, combined together. And like that's the thing I think about a lot, like how, like not just what's going on now but what has been going on, and kind of the conditions that lead to what's happening now. Like you can go like silly with it where it's like, oh, I need to know like the entire 1,000-year history, and it doesn't need to be that much, but like what are the visible parts and what are some of the invisible parts is something I think about a lot. And a lot of that comes from like non-fiction reading as well, that kind of reinforces that. Like I read a lot of non-fiction as well as fiction, but
like history books, archaeology, this kind of stuff.
Yeah like a lot of that stuff. Like I read there's one called The Golden Rhinoceros that's really cool, where it's like looking at the history of like Africa as a continent through like a few specific artifacts. And that's like fantastic. It's a really well-written book. I believe it was translated from the French, but it's just really nice as a way to approach history through these like specific artifacts, kind of talking about like, how did it get where they found it? What's its kind of origin? It's kind of like meanings. So yeah, that's a really good one. Golden Rhinoceros, for that's like a big influence on like, and treasure. Yeah, really good one.
Nice. Do you continue to travel to explore these places? And if you do, would there be maybe any famous ruins or place that you would like to visit and, you know, experience?
Obviously, over the past few years, a bit less. So we had like lockdown, and then me and my wife got married last year. So not so much travel lately, but it's definitely something I'd like to do. There's a few places kind of always wanted to see, both kind of natural and ruins. Like I've always wanted to see some of the deserts in the southern United States. I've just thought they'd be like, because obviously we don't have anything like that in the UK. There's no desert here. So seeing something that's like so totally different would be really cool. There's a lot of like kind of some of the European ruins as well that are kind of like very classic to see. I've also been quite interested in visiting, the name's entirely escaped me now, sort of some of the regions of Southeast Asia have been like ones that I've done like some reading on lately, and that would be like really cool to see that, especially because like a lot less of it is known due to like obviously like the specific history there, where a lot of like records were like deliberately destroyed or whatever. So it's like, what can you see that's still there is like an interesting thing to work with and think about. But yeah, like it's definitely something I want to do more of.
Yeah, of course. And look, this podcast is now kind of about the weird, and we see the weird in a positive light, like the weird is the new wonderful. But I also love to ask the guests who comes here that make this wonderful weird creations and adventures, and you do this especially well. So what I'd like to ask is, how do you define the weird for yourself, and how do you seek that in your work and in your life in general?
It's an odd one, because I think like a lot of the stuff I'm into is kind of like broadly regarded as like weird shit. like my everything's kind of from like my music tastes. Like my wife's always like, why do you like this? to like a lot of the books I'm reading, like I've always, I think like even like as a kid, like partly due to exposure to like alternative stuff, but I was never like interested in like what was in TV or like the books that were like age appropriate or whatever. Like, it's always like, what if it was like aggressively weird? What if it like was trying to make me uncomfortable? Like a big one was like picking up the first edition of Warhammer 40,000, because my dad was really into this stuff before. And the art, wow, in that is like super hardcore, like lots of like black and white, like horrible mutilated bodies and all this like cool stuff. And I think that was like, I was like, oh my god, like it doesn't have to be what's on TV or like on the radio. Like there's like a whole other world here. And I was like, I just kind of have always wanted more and more of that. And like getting older, you just kind of get the freedom to do that and find more people who are into the same like weird shit. Yeah, like it's kind of like, it's also, I think because it's, the weird stuff is always, it doesn't need to be defined in like opposition to like mainstream or whatever, but it's like there's often at least like a kind of disinterest there, which I think kind of spoke to me as well, where it is just kind of like, I'm just off doing my own thing, and like if people want to see it, great, and if not, no worries as well, like see you around.
Yeah
that's like it's a big approach. Question
yeah.
Because yeah, I think if you set yourself in opposition to, then it's kind of like you end up as defined by the main course, yeah, as not, right? Like, whereas if you're just off doing your own thing,
that's true.
Then you kind of get to forge your own path, which is like fun. Like I always joke about doing things the hard way on purpose, but like part of that is true. Like part of it is like, you know, like the big example I always use, like I used to hate writing magic items, so I wrote 100 of them for Anne Treasure, and now I can, it's fine, it doesn't bother me anymore, which is like the hardest solution, but it was like the one that I wanted to do, sort of thing.
Yeah, but maybe I think I do that too. Maybe we do what is uncomfortable, because not to be contrarian, as you said, but we find ourselves through facing those struggles, those difficulties. It's a way for to explore authenticity, because I think that's what it is. It's not being in opposition to what is normal. It's just being authentic and comfortable in being whatever it is that's you. If you're different, if you're like everybody else, I don't know, just be who you are in a way that's comfortable for you and you find it interesting. So, and sometimes we find it interesting facing these challenges to really find out what is that we do, our creativity, and how we can do these things better, right?
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. I think that's spot on, where it is that, like, yeah, like a self-challenge almost. And, like, you can do that in any field. Like, sometimes it's like, again, like, even with music, like, I like quite extreme music, and sometimes it's like, oh, man, this is a bit too extreme for me, so I'll listen to the album and see how I feel by the end of it, sort of thing. But, like, still being able to hopefully appreciate it, even if it's not for you as well. I think, yeah, like, I think a lot of it is coming to stuff at where it's at, like, rather than trying to, like, impose your own kind of set of values or, like, orders onto something, just being like, oh, okay, like, what does this prioritize? Like, what is this interested in? And, like, if the thing it's interested in is, like, a 20-second song, great, they achieved that. They did a really good job or something. Yeah, and I think that's part of it as well. Like, there's a kind of willingness to let somebody else show you what they're doing and being like, oh, cool, like, and even if the, you know, not for me, but thanks for showing me, sort of thing. And that's something I've always tried to do, like, in real life. It's just like, oh, like, what are you into? Like, and, it, you know, most people will have, like, a thing that's like, oh, that's interesting, tell me about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you have any kind of maybe creative ritual or anything that you do before you start writing or working on your projects? Maybe put some music, put your shoes on, something that helps you get into the mood of your creative work?
I mean, depending on how well things are flowing or not, like if I'm like in the zone, like I, when I was working a more conventional job, like a big thing was like I'd wake up an hour early, put something on the vinyl player, and just write for an hour before I had to start work properly, which was like, that was really nice. Whereas now, like, the more common thing I'll do is just turn the internet off. So I've got like an extender right by my foot to kind of kick the switch, turn that off, and just kind of like isolate myself a bit. Like I've got kind of music ready to go, just yeah, turn it off and just work away at whatever it is I'm trying to do for an hour or two, to really like kind of knuckle down and get it done. It
Why
is
do
definitely...
you turn the internet
oh,
off?
It's because otherwise I'll be like, oh, I'll just go research that, and then I'll fall down like a Wikipedia hole, and it's like an hour later, I'm like, fuck this shit, I didn't get anything done. So for me, just if the internet's off, I don't even think to look it up. I'll just like put something there, like, oh, I'll come back to this, no worries, and just carry on. I don't need to know the answer right now. So I'll have like a paper thesaurus and stuff, like sort of above my desk, like it's just there. Like I don't need to Google it, and it's like, sure, it takes longer, but it means I'm not opening myself up to being so easily distracted, which is like a big thing. I try and like be very deliberate about having focus. It's something that like bothers me when I can't focus on something, and the big problem is computers. Like if I'm reading a book, it's fine. That is the other thing sometimes as well, is I'll every now and then just write out the thing I'm working on by hand, rather than using the computer, because again, there's no distractions in a notebook. It's you just write in the notebook, that's all you can do, so you just do it, which works really well for me, kind of removing the possibility of doing something else.
Yeah, and I read about this too, that writing by hand, since it's kind of the slowest way for you to take a note of something, you memorize it more because you take more time to do it. You think it more truthfully. So if you're trying to study or memorize or think about something, yeah, it is better to write by hand because to help you to focus. So that's all very good strategies. And now I'm thinking about maybe turning off the internet when I sit down to write something. That's a very good idea. Maybe not. Maybe just for me, you know, like in my computer, just turn it off, because the rest of the family will want to, you know, the kid wants to watch YouTube and whatever. So yeah, but that's a great idea. Thank you for that.
Yeah, it's just one thing that I realized. I was like, I'm just spending so much time Googling stuff. Like, just don't, you don't need to know it right now. Like, just take a note, come back to it later. Like, because, especially because my previous job was quite, like, low intensity in some ways. So, like, if I had, like, a few minutes here and there, it's like, oh, I'll just quickly do the research I'm meant to do. So, like, I had lots of time to fill with little bits like that. Whereas, like, the time where I can knuckle down, focus, and not worry about distractions, that's, like, quite precious. So, take maximum advantage sort of thing.
Yeah. You mentioned, you know, your previous job, and you don't have to talk about it if you don't want to, but who is Luke Gearing outside of RPGs? Like, do you still have a secret identity job outside of role-playing games that you do? Because that's how I refer to my job. Like, I go to my job and this is my secret identity. Like, this is not me.
So I used to do cybersecurity for, it was about 7 years that I did cybersecurity stuff, for two big companies. One of them, like, we kind of sold our services elsewhere, and the most recent one was for a budget hotel chain in the UK. Nothing super high stakes, nothing exciting or dangerous. So that was what I was doing for 7 years. But obviously, as Sean put out, I'm now working for Tuesday Night Games full time. So it's just all RPGs now, which has been like a weird adjustment, because the thing that used to be like my main hobby is now my job. I need to make sure I have stuff to do that isn't RPGs. So that's like an ongoing process where it's like I just need to be very deliberate about it. Like, I'm still running my games with my friends, because there's always have been quite divorced. Like, it's like my friends who I know in real life, we play like sort of twice a week. That's the, you know, that doesn't interfere with the day job, as it were. But there's like, especially like over the weekends, like if my wife's away or whatever, it's, I'm kind of sitting there like, I can't write all weekend because I'm doing that all week. So like, I need to make sure I'm doing something. I don't just want to get back into just playing video games or anything. Like, I want to make sure I'm doing stuff interesting. So once the weather gets better, my parents got me like a barbecue thing for Christmas. It's like a big fireball barbecue thing. So I'll probably get really into that. And just trying new, like different things, because I've got time back in a way. Because it's the day job now, which is, it's weird that a job has given me more time, but there you go.
Yeah. That's something I worry about. I thought for a while and maybe trying to just live off games, but I was worried that turning something that I love or that I do, you know, for pleasure, that I, even though I make some money off it, you know, making this the sole breadwinner for me, I was afraid to, you know, spoil it in a way.
Yeah, you
know, if you have that fear. And as you talked, like, you maybe probably need like a hobby outside of role-playing games. And that's one of the questions I asked here too, if you have a hobby outside of it. But that's something you are seeking, because your hobby was this, right? And now you're going through this transition and having to find someone else to distract you for your hobby kind of work, right? And helps you also have ideas, like explore your creativity outside of needing to make money out of it, right?
For sure. Like, it, you know, it was never like the only thing I was doing, but it was definitely like I was spending a lot of my free time kind of writing and like kind of thinking about games and playing them. So there's a lot of like, you know, like me and my friends will still look at a lot of board games and stuff, but I want to make sure I have stuff that's like sufficiently divorced from games where it can still be like enriching, because I think you can only be as good as your influences to some degree, so it's important to make sure that you don't silo yourself and just consume games stuff, because then everything you make is derivative of games, and it's
you get to
a weird problem where things kind of second order, like not truly original, whereas you kind of want to be able to come up with like those fresh new ideas and combinations which needs rich influences.
I think that's for all kinds of art, right? Like if you're a writer, if you're a movie maker, anything, you have to differentiate your sources, right? Have a very varied input so your output can be richer, I would say.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, I mean, it's such a like kind of classic truism, right? That like, yeah, you can't, if you make movies, you gotta go read books, you know, or you gotta go and watch plays. You can't just be films all the time. You gotta really vary it. And I think possibly especially in games, because I think a lot of games are so directly inspired by other forms of media that you end up kind of very quickly like kind of end up in a very shallow pool of inspiration there, where it's kind of like, oh, this is like, this game's inspired by this media property, and then if I'm inspired by that, you've kind of immediately got the problem where there's a lack of fresh ideas. Like a lot of the reading I do is like very not directly gameable. Like I had like a big phase into like very weird philosophy stuff, and turning any of that gameable was like fun and difficult, because it wasn't directly related at all. So that was like good fun. And like
what was this very weird philosophical?
Oh, there's like a few. Like a big one that I got into a few years ago was Spinal Catastrophism, which is an absolutely wild book, which is it's hard to summarize. It kind of is taking the spine as a like historical record of all the different kind of like levels of and things that have happened to humanity, and it gets into all kinds of like weird stuff. Like it kind of at the preface it's saying like this is taking not necessarily true ideas, but seeing what they can show us anyway. So it gets into like weird kind of like alternate like evolutionary routes for humans. It gets into like UFOs, about like weird kind of like political formations. It kind of throws it all together in a really compelling and like interesting way. Like I really love that book. It's fantastic. And yeah, it's just like constantly throwing new things at you, like weird angles of thought, which is just like, oh, okay, like I think I get it.
Yeah.
And there's like another one that's like, I think it's like the phenomenology of a vampire squid. And it's like, what is the mind of a vampire squid like? It tries to relate like how human is it, how non-human is it, and kind of what shared context do we have. So there's a lot of like people doing very interesting thinking out there. Which is just very outside of the norm, and it's just fun to engage with and kind of think about and then try and apply somewhere else. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah. And all these things sometimes just trigger something in our imagination. So yeah, maybe I can explore that and maybe use this weird octopus in an adventure. Maybe the way they reproduce or the way they do something, you steal and make things weirder for your games too. And I don't know. Sure. It's always hard to turn the creative mind off, right? As you watch those things and read about it, you're always... Do you feel like that? You're always seeking how you can...
Oh, yeah, it's terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you'd be like, oh, this film's great. I could turn it into such a cool campaign. It's like, just enjoy the film as a film first.
Yeah. And sometimes I feel like, stop doing that. Enjoy the fucking film. Why are you thinking about games right now? You're like, just enjoy. You can think about it after, but it's sometimes you can't
You can't turn it off. Yeah. It's very, it's like, sometimes you're like, fine, like, okay, I guess that's how we're analyzing things today. Yeah, it's very funny because, like you say, it isn't something you get a choice about. Sometimes it's just it's happening.
Yeah, you mentioned inspiration too, and one thing I always ask guests here because it's something that affects me. So I ask, have you ever been inspired, or are you inspired by maybe an artist, creator, or writer? It can be from any genre, any media, not necessarily role playing games. That maybe you model the way they approach their craft or the way they position themselves in the community. In a way that's like, have you had any mentors, even though they might not have sit down to teach you, but have you studied the work of some creators and tried to model them to arrive at your own style, or your own way to do things?
There's like, I think about Steve Albini a lot, who was a record producer, and he's in a couple of bands. Like, he has a very kind of workmanlike approach to a lot of things, but he also is like very unabashed about the things he likes. Like, he has this famous quote, was like, I like fucking noise, I want it loud, and I don't care if you kind of like it. And that was like a, yeah, like he knows what he wants to do, and like the people who hire him knows what he's gonna do, and he won't meet them in the middle. Like, if you hire me, it's because you want the thing that I do well. So he's like a guy I think about a lot, and I think he's very interesting. I'm trying to think if there's anyone else that's like an immediate kind of like, oh, of course, this person. He's the one that I always go back to, I think, in a big way, like in terms of approach to his craft.
And does he talk a lot about this, how he approached his craft?
Where
did you learn
he's...
about the way he does things?
So I got into one of his bands, Shellac, which is like definitely the best one of his bands in my opinion. And from there, just started reading about the guy, and kind of he has like, as I say, it's he does talk about it, but it's always very like straight and matter of the fact and quite prosaic, where it's just kind of like, yeah, you just turn up and you do your job, and like you ask them what they want and that kind of thing. It's just it's not. He doesn't sort of pontificate upon it in the way that like some artists will, where they're kind of talking more about like a muse or whatever. For him, it seems very much like I'm solving problems, which I always really liked and really appreciated as like, perhaps almost because it's like countervailing to the general kind of way artists will speak about themselves, where they will talk about like cultivating artist spirit and. Like a red.
It's a very design way to approach art, like solving problems. But it's very how you learn about game design is about, you know, you have a problem and you analyze it and you come up with a solution. And it's not really normally how artists see art, right? It's just exploring an idea.
Yeah. Well, I think it's because it's partially because it's countervailing, partially because it's like, oh, like what happens if you think about things that way, but also because it's.
Yeah.
It's not like the default, right? Like the default is kind of like you're channeling like something else and kind of just trying to put it on the page without yourself getting in the way. Like, because there's like, there is the kind of like very much like, oh, art is constructed by like the skill of the artist idea, which like, okay, sure, fine. Like you have to have craft. But there is also the, like, I think it's Jack Spicer has this thing about Martians sending him his poems like directly to his brain. And they're just like the stuff in his head is the furniture that they move around, and it's not like literally Martians, but the point being he's like trying to remove himself, like himself as himself as much as possible from the creative act, and like being surprised by his own work, which I find really interesting, where it's not like an intricate, like, because you have something like Ulysses, right? Like it's like, oh, it's this big kind of puzzle and it's all very intricate and put together in a specific way, and this is like the total opposite of that, where it is like, oh, like, I don't know what it's about. Like, I can think about it and talk to you about what it's about, but, like, I don't know in an objective way, which is, like, see, probably, like, Jack Spicer stuff is, like, the opposite, because I quite like having the two aspects in opposition and intention. Like, it's the whole idea of, like, healthy tension, right, where it's, like,
yeah,
these, if these two things are true at the same time, what does that do? What does that mean? And kind of allowing that mutual incompatibility to try and sort of drive things, where, like, you know, like, simultaneously solving the problems of how best to represent a dungeon whilst also trying to be like, how do I write this thing in such a way that I'm surprised and kind of happy at what I find there, rather than being too there in the process. And that's like an enjoyable tightrope to walk, I think.
Oh yeah, I think it's always this balance between opposing things that makes things interesting, because you're always trying to find out what will happen and creates the uncertainty. It has a structure because both those things imply certain narrative, but because they are like opposite to each other, you create suspense in a way and interesting in that way, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. Like it's. No. Because you can feel like if a project's leaning too far, like sort of one way or the other. And this isn't like the only tension. Like there's also things where like, do you want to be specific or do you want to be like inspirational? It's obviously you want to be both, but sometimes those two things are in opposition. Where it's like if I give you the precise measurements of this door, sure you know the precise measurements of the door, but you're less likely to imagine the door in some ways. Whereas if I can just tell you like, oh, it's like a not a spooky door, but you know what I mean? Like kind of describe the feeling of seeing the door, then I'm going to build the image in your head much more efficiently. But sometimes you need those specific measurements. And again, that's like a fun tension to hold.
Yeah. It's a marker for a very good writer, as you said, to know when you do one and when you do the other, when you are really specific, because that will also help you tell a story, will help you establish the characters, will help you even... people become more familiarized, because sometimes familiarity isn't, you know, being, this is applicable to everything, but it is so specific that you also can recognize that experience or that thing in yourself, even though you haven't lived through it. I think that's, fiction does a lot of that, I think.
No, yeah, definitely. Like, I think the specificity thing where it's like, you can almost hit something truer by being so specific. Like, I think if you try and talk generally in like in a lot of fiction stuff, you end up, if you, it becomes so non-specific that it kind of becomes nothing. It's kind of just an empty cloud that looks like something. But like, if it's really specific and really concrete, then like we can kind of read it as like, oh, this is like a thing that exists and I can relate to it as a thing that exists, even though it doesn't capture my general experience. It's like, I still recognize it on some level. And I think that's like a good thing to do in writing, like generally.
It's like those fantasy settings that sometimes it's just like, well, okay, another one with elves in the forest, dwarves in the mountains, and, you know, orcs in the dungeons. And it has some, like, for me, I'm sorry to say, but it's kind of Forgotten Helms. Forgotten Helms try to be so much, and everything has, everything is in there. And when I think about Forgotten Helms, I can't picture an image that, oh, this setting is about this, because it's so much. But if I think about maybe Dark Sun, I have a much clearer and specific and also immersive view of the setting than Forgotten Helms, because it has a very strong, it is about something. It's about this, it's about struggle, it's about scarcity, it's about, you know, fight for survival, it's about fight for equality in a way. And Forgotten Helms is about everything, so it's about nothing in a way.
It's nothing. It's too permissive, right? Like it's so wide that it stops existing. Like it's you know, like how if you compress like a gas, you can kind of like see the color, and if it's too diffuse, it's nothing. It's invisible.
Hello weirdos, this is Diogo Nogueira and I'm back with a word from our sponsors. Me, I just released a new game called Cosmosaurus, in which you play a dinosaur space ranger who protects the galaxy from evil threats such as slime bankers, undead pirates, and cosmosaurus from a void dimension. It's a game with a runes-light system inspired by Forge in the Dark and Lasers and Feelings. It comes with a bunch of tables for you to generate content for it. If you know my games, they're really easy to play and they have tools to help you improvise and play with low prep. It's an ideal game for one-shots, short campaigns, and introducing new people to the hobby, and it's a really perfect family game. I play with my kids all the time. It's a game inspired by Saturday morning cartoons. It's really well illustrated by Lukasz Kowalski from Poland, and with a great layout by Guillermo Gontijo. It's a really fun game. You should check it out on DriveThruRPG, itch.io, or exclusively in print on ExaltedFunner.com. I have many other games there, check them out. All the links are in the show notes, so click there. And let's get back to Weird with our chat.
Look, do you identify any kind of mark or style or voice in your work? And if you do, can you tell us a little bit, what do you see that kind of unifies or ties your work, and if someone would see and think, yeah, this is Ruggieri's work?
I mean, the big one, when I'm being mean about myself, I say it's all Cormac McCarthy fan fiction. Where I'm just trying to use as few words as possible, try and, like, a big thing I really like in his work is that he doesn't tend to express the interiority of his characters. It's just like, here's what's here. Like, I'm just writing down the stuff that happened and what's there, and the rest of it's kind of on you. And that's, I find that, like, really interesting and aspirational, where it's just like, yeah, I'm just going to tell you what's there and leave everything else out. In terms of, like, other, like, kind of, like, thematic markers, I think, like I said before, like, kind of history and geography, like, the big ones, like, there's, like, a physical place and there's, like, a history that happened. Generally, they all tend to be pretty miserable. I think I've done, like, a couple of funny ones, but even those have, like, a slightly nasty edge to them. Like, the big squirm, like, you know, it's funny, it's about big scarf worms that eat people. But there's also, like, kind of an angle of, like, kind of organized crime and, like, a kind of an assassination campaign. So, yeah, I think there's always a more or less kind of degree of unpleasantness in everything I write. Which, like, maybe that's the thing I need to challenge myself and try and do something nice next time. we'll see.
But do you see yourself as someone more, see the world through a more critical lens? Do you is this a reflection of how you see the world, or do you feel more positive? But I also see a lot that adventures need conflict, and sometimes is this a fantasy of us to, like, this bleak world and characters go there and try to survive and make it on their own? Because it's kind of the way you said, like, you like to explore challenges to see what you make, what you create out of it. So maybe that reflects on your work too. You create really challenging and miserable things to see what can be created out of this thing. Do you see any relation in that?
There's definitely something there, I think, to it, where it's like, if you, like, if the world's already good, like, for a game, if the world's already good, then you're just kind of, like, you're just kind of policeman. You're just maintaining the status quo. Whereas if there's, like, bad stuff in the world, like there is in the real world, then, like, the choice to try and make things better is a choice. And it's like, you have to do something. You can't just do nothing and kind of wait. That said, I also think, like, certainly for me, a lot of, like, the really horrible stuff, it's kind of funny as well.
It is, like, you hit, in a way.
You hit a point where it's, like, so over the top and so miserable that it's just, it's funny at that point. And, like, you're like, oh yeah, like, the horrible brain slugs are, like, eating all the orphans or something. And it's like, oh, like, it hits a point where it, like, it flips back around. It's like, this is so ridiculous that it just kind of becomes farcical.
Yeah.
I think in terms of, like, because I think I'm generally a relatively, like, positive person, but I think some of that is maintaining awareness of the world, and, like, you know, there's definitely a lot of things wrong at the moment, to put it mildly. But I think you can view them critically,
but it's unfair too, because we now today we can be aware of everything that's going on all around the world, and there's always terrible things. They have always been, not just now. And just now we have big news covering big wars, But I think every time there is terrible wars going on, and sometimes we don't know when we're fine about it. But now, just because the TV is showing, we're like, it's terrible. It is terrible, but it's also we seek terrible news so much,
and yeah, there's because there is the general statistic is that as like violent crime goes down, reporting on it goes up, right? Because it sells. If it bleeds, it leads, right? That's the kind of the newspaper angle, and I think a lot of that's been so productized and commercialized as part of like 24/7 news cycles and stuff. And like stuff with like the atrocities happening during the stuff that's happening at the moment, like it absolutely does need to be reported on. I think part of being a global citizen, as it were, is like you kind of have, if you have access to that knowledge, you almost sometimes you can feel like you have a duty to know, which I don't know. Like, you should, if you can do something, I think you should try and do something. Obviously, there's points where you can and you can't do something. Like, a big one for me was, like, during the COVID lockdowns in the UK, like, and there was, like, all the time they were, like, telling you, oh, the number's gone up, and, like, it's like, well, I don't need to know that. Like, me knowing that doesn't change my actions. I'm respecting the lockdown. So, like, I did hit a point then where I was like, I'm just not going to check the news anymore. There's no, like, I'm not, at least on this specific topic, like there's no value to me knowing the number creeping up right now. Like there has to be an accounting at the end, obviously, and what happened and why and who's responsible in terms
but
of
also
like, why didn't
have
we
to
do
be
enough.
Aware of what is good for you and what is not, because that can make you worse, that can make you anxious, that can make you and then you forget that cares you have to take, because you're all focusing on this bad news all the time, and maybe you forget to do what you need to do. So
it's that tension, right? You have to be able to look after yourself and you know, touch grass and be like, I exist in this place, in this like world, but also I should be aware and do what I can for stuff happening further away as well. Like, you know, you can't set yourself to keep, you can't set yourself on fire to keep someone else warm, but you should try and help them. It's like give them a blanket, as it were. Like, but again, two sort of things have to be true at the same time.
Yeah. Look, what has been maybe the weirdest game you ever played, or maybe if not the weirdest, a weird game you played recently that maybe made an impression on you and made you think maybe in different ways games can work? And it can be role-playing games, it can be video games, and it can be board games, and it can be just a play you do with your friends in like a LARP or something.
So like two big role-playing game experiences that stick out in my mind is those for one of my friend's birthdays, I was running, I think it was Cthulhu Dark that we were running, and me and a very good friend as well, best friend at the wedding, we didn't tell the person whose birthday it was, but we just started swapping who was GM in the middle of like talking, and he was very fucked up by that. So that was like a really fun one where it's like, if you can kind of call into question like the actual player roles, you do something very interesting there, where it, like, if you rug pull that and then everyone's kind of like I don't know where I'm standing, which for a horror game, fantastic, because like you want everyone to feel on edge, not sure what on earth is happening. So that was really good fun as like a big one. The other one that I always remember is we were again weirdly playing Call of Cthulhu, and it was a pre-published scenario, but basically it turns out like one character had like many lives living within his head of everyone else, and he was trapped in a time loop, and like this awful thing was going to happen, and like your options were either like let the thing happen, or if I worth content wanted this one, or just like kill yourself, and those were like the character's choices, and it ended up with all of my friends effectively in a circle around me all yelling at me, you need to kill yourself, which was extremely intense as a scenario. But again, it's one that I'm always like, damn, like that was like, and they, you know, they talk about like bleed in LARPs, and it was like, yeah, that was like a lot to go through. Like we all laughed about it afterwards because like we're all friends, very comfortable with each other, but it was in the moment I was like, fucking hell, this is an odd one. In terms of board games, one I come back to a lot is Psycho Raiders, which is like a horror movie simulator board game, But it uses like hex and counter war game mechanics, which I love this game. I think it's great. Where if you're playing as the survivors, you've got terrible odds. But it's a really good like little story generator where like you have to kind of process everything through the rules as much as you can because it's a board game. We agree to follow the rules. It's not like a role playing game where they're tools. And it just generates fantastic little moments. By
what's
putting
the
something
name?
That Psycho Raiders. But yeah, the fact it uses like a war game chassis to do a horror movie, it's like two things that on the face of it, like, that doesn't work, that doesn't make sense. And then you play it and it's like, oh shit, this is incredible, this is really fun. So that's one I always come back to as like in terms of board games. It's really good fun.
Yeah, I see nowadays constantly games like board games drawing for RPGs, so there are board games that really plays with telling stories and playing characters. And also RPGs are drawing a lot from board games on how to structure rooms, to have the way you play the game kind of in a structured way, like a board game. You have a beginning, a middle, and an end. Those games that are more like telling stories. And yeah. I think that's helping, like we're exploring the limits of the hobby. You mentioned a few minutes ago how if you just study role-playing games or games, you become limited because it is a medium that is really recent and haven't been explored the way, you know, literature or music or other mediums that are older than ours have. And for a while, our reference was these other mediums, like in the 80s and 90s. The late 80s and 90s was really all about this idea of, you know, telling stories. The GM is there like to tell this epic, and the adventures were really linear. And it was really referenced on literature. But now we're starting to see the media can do a lot more. And indie RPGs are exploring these different possibilities. So I think that's also very healthy. And do you have anything you would like to explore, or any kind of a dream project or a weird thing that you think about exploring in future projects?
Oh, that's a tough one. I just wanted to expand on what you were saying with kind of the way games have changed from like the 80s, 90s, kind of early aughts as well, if that's right. Because I think we're hitting like a big explosion of like styles of play to the point where like role-playing games are almost not a useful term anymore. Like there's like you can look at
that's
like
a
very kind of like linear trad style and like, I don't know, something very experimental, weird, like a kind of... nothing immediately springs to mind, but there's almost like a lack of, like, it's almost like the shared language holds back comparing them. Like they're both called role-playing games, but in terms of practicality and what you're actually doing, they're like so different. Like a GM-less game compared to a very much like a linear trad, like here's the adventure book and we're playing through it beginning to end. Like they're so divorced as to be like, I don't know which one should be called a role-playing game. We just abandon the term and start using a whole bunch of different terms. So it's very interesting how like, it's like saying, oh, I like sports now, saying role-playing games. Like, yeah, like, which one? And it was like, if I'm playing football and you're playing tennis and we're trying to talk about the same thing, we're going to have a very weird conversation that's not going to be the most useful. Whereas if it's like, we both know that we're talking about different sports and comparing them, oh, cool, that's really interesting. Like, there's a weird crossover there, or, oh, man, that's totally different. So it's like an interesting one with the explosion and change of tone in games. In terms of weird projects I want to work on, at some point I want to do another just silly big one like Wolves, just because it was really good fun to write. I keep thinking about, I bought and read The Mask of Nathaliotep slipcase, the big KSEM adventure, and it's not great. It's pretty overwritten, in my opinion. So at some point, I want to do my take on a big kind of, I wouldn't run it linear, but like a big kind of campaign length adventure that still has like one kind of narrative thrust to it. Like that isn't specifically a sandbox, just because I've done the sandbox thing now. I want to see what I would do with something that isn't linear, but has like a, you're doing this thing, go. That's one thing I really want to explain.
Like a meta plot or something.
Yeah.
There is this setting, but there is this main thing that's happening that's affecting the group. and they will have to deal one in or the other, or it will deal with them in a way, right?
Yeah, for sure. Or even just like one thing I was talking about with a friend is like just giving the players like a job. Like, here's the sandbox, but like you have a job, you work for somebody, and that's like, that doesn't change. We've agreed that's working. That's what's happening. So like,
yeah,
go and do something about it. Because I think that's, especially for players who are a bit less like kind of confident in the sandbox format, I think that can be really useful. Just being like, look, when I ran Warhammer Fantasy, it was like, okay, you are Witch Hunters. Like, that's the campaign. Like, if you don't like it, this isn't the campaign for you. But they were all like, yeah, no, sounds cool. Like, that sounds fun. Mm-hmm. And it worked really well, because it was like, whenever they weren't sure what to do, it's like, well, I guess we're going to hunt witches. It's really good fun.
Yeah, it's a great idea. And it functions because it focuses the campaign. It always gives them a motivation. And especially from players that are not really super familiar with all different kinds of games we play, like indie games, having this very, you are this, you're going to do this, and like your mission is that, gives them a direction, but they can also explore outside of it, because people on the job always, you know, do something different too. So
yeah, absolutely, yeah. Okay, it gives you a good balance. Yeah. Like, my ideal is still, here's a big sandbox, you go find the interesting thing you want to do, but that's not right for every table, and it's like worth having tools in your toolbox for different kinds of players.
Yeah. Look, now we're getting about in the middle of the episode, and I normally switch more personal questions, and I would like to begin asking about maybe weird experiences you might have had in your life that made you rethink the way you do things, or rethink your feelings and your thoughts. Like, have you ever had experience with deep meditation or hypnosis, or maybe out of body experiences that made you, I don't know, see reality in a different way?
I've never done like a successful like a deep meditation, but I do like try and meditate sort of semi-regularly. I mean, the ideal is once a day, but we're getting there. That's very interesting, realizing how much kind of like background noise there is in your mind. Like the kind of disordered clutter of thinking. I can't remember where I read a quote somewhere that like most people are sleepwalking most of the time, and the idea is like, if you're not thinking about the thing you're doing, you're not really doing it. Yes. Which kind of ruined podcasts for me in some ways, because then it's like, like obviously like, so if you're driving or like doing whatever, like it's, but like the idea that, yeah, you should be thinking about what you're doing all the time. And, like, it's exhausting to live that way, but it is very rewarding. Like, I remember I had one really good day where everything I was doing, I was 100% engaged in just the thing I was doing. There wasn't any kind of distracting background thoughts. And, like, even washing the dishes, like, after dinner was, like, really, like, it just felt great to do it, because I was like, I'm washing the dishes, I'm doing it really well, I put them away, what do I want to do now? And rather than having, like, something buzzing around in my head, I was like, I'm going to I'm going to read this book because I want to, and that's it. Like, it's total absorption in every act. It was incredible. And that's like kind of my gold standard for what a good day looks like now. Which is hard to achieve. Like, it's a lot of work.
It is very difficult. Like, even like watching TV and not checking your phone, for me it's like, it's a training that I do, and I put my phone away. Even enjoying like the shows, and I like comedies a lot, and sometimes I'm watching something and I have to check some message, some email, and I lose so much, and it's very true. Like, this training of mindfulness, you know, to be present in the moment and just enjoy and take the most of it, it's difficult, I think, especially nowadays, or depending how your mind works. And I can imagine doing this a full day like this.
It was hard, a really nice day.
The
big thing that I did for that is I've got like a drug dealer's phone as my main phone, so that I don't get, it doesn't have any good apps on it, so I don't get distracted.
For the weirdos who aren't watching this, you know, drug dealer's phone is like the old phone with buttons instead of,
it's,
you
an
know,
old Nokia.
The screen. Yeah.
So like, yeah, all of my wife hates it. Her friends think it's, or some, they're split, some of them think it's cool. My friends hate it because they hate when I do weird stuff, which is, it's also fun to annoy them by doing weird stuff.
Have you had this phone for a long while, or is this something recent?
I think it's about half a year. I've had it for now. Oh, yeah. Because I got it.
You got it because of that, because of distraction, right? Or why did
you? Yeah, well, like, my old phone was on the way out, and I'd been kind of toying with the idea anyway. And I was like, you know what? I'll just pull the trigger. I'll try it. And I'm loving it. Like, it's great. You can't do a lot on it, and that's ideal, because I only need it to stay in contact with people if I'm out, basically, because I work from home.
Yeah.
And if I need to look up directions, I just look them up ahead of time and write them down. It's fine. It's yeah. You know, it was how people used to get around. It wasn't that bad.
Very old school.
Yeah, it's nice. It's, and like, I think if you're, this is a big thing in video games, right? Where if they have a little mini map with a compass on it, you just stare at the compass because the arrow tells you where to go. Whereas if you have to actually like look and be like, oh, turn left at the tree. It's like, there's the tree. I'm in that world a lot more, right? And you can do that.
Oh yeah.
You can do that with real life as well. Like, you just look at your sat nav. You don't look at what's going on around you and like, oh, read a road sign. Okay, I'm going this way, going that way. And the same thing when you're walking. If you're looking at the phone telling you where to go, you're not looking at the road names and like thinking about like, oh, I wonder where that road name comes from. Like, you're entirely shut off from that. Which is like, yeah, that's a big thing I've been working on the past couple of years, is like, yeah, being in the world and like paying attention, because it's so easy to get distracted, especially like as a kid growing up on computers a lot. I now have like a much deeper appreciation of everything that isn't computers. Just anything real is like, yeah, like that's inherently superior. Like, the computer's fine, but it can't be the beginning and end of everything. It has to be a supplement.
I'm sorry to ask that, but how old are you, and when did you have this realization of, you know, living in the moment? Because you seem young and you know, having this
no,
wisdom
fine.
Is
I'm 29.
Very rare.
Wow. So I think I started getting like serious about this stuff probably maybe like a couple of years ago is when I like started actually like actively doing it, but like,
but what made you be serious about this?
So it would have been about 26, 27 is when I started like, okay, like I'll buy the fucking meditation cushion and I'll sit on it and I'll see what happens. Like, I'll try and not always have a podcast on. Like, I won't die if I don't have earphones in when I walk the dog in the morning. Like, I'll just let my brain wake up a little bit before I start blasting it with like whatever's happening wherever. It's, and like, there's ways to approach stuff where it's like, you know, there's like thoughtful ways of listening to podcasts where you're like engaging and you're listening, and then there's like, what, like for me especially, and this might just be me with like auditory processing, but like, if I have it on in the background, it's like in one ear out the other, like I don't absorb anything. But some people, that's like listening to a lecture, they learn the whole thing. For me, I've got to write it down or read it, or else it's not going, I'm not, it's gone, I'm not handling that information.
Yeah,
I think that's like, that's the like the biggest kind of mode shift for me, like in recent years.
You just had the awareness that you were not taking full advantage of things you're doing, right? Yeah.
And again, it might have been COVID as well, because like cooped up inside, like realizing you've not been outside for weeks, like, I'll just go start taking walks. And it's like, oh wow, I feel so much better. I'm no longer like stressed out as hell. Like, crazy how that works, right? And another big moment was like, it's one thing knowing on an intellectual level that like going outside is good for you and walks are good for you, but actually like hitting the point where you need to, like, you don't forget that, you never forget how you felt, and how much better you felt for deliberately taking steps. So it's like looking after your mind as well as that is like very important to me.
I was talking to Lex Mandrake yesterday, and we were talking about how important and how it is that we do exercise and stuff, that even though we don't like it, it's not like we feel good doing it, it's that we feel worse not doing it. So it's like, that's why like we're exercising, because it's worse not doing it. And you feel better. Like, while you're doing it, it's not great. Like, you're sweating, you get sore, and etc. But after and before, if you have it like a regularity or consistent with it, you feel much better. Like at least I do. Like I started exercising more regularly, like 6 months ago or something, and feel much better and more well disposed. I'm able to write and create every day. I wasn't being able to do that. I wasn't patient. You know, it helps with a lot of stuff, I think.
Yeah, it's very frustrating how it's one of those ones where I'm like, oh, I guess the adults were right. Like, You can feel really annoyed that it's like they were wrong about everything else, but this one thing I guess they were right about. I guess I should exercise. I guess I will have more energy. Like I about a year ago, I think, I started doing the gym. That's been like really good for me as well. Like, it's the point now where if I don't go for a week, all my joints start locking up. It's like click, yeah. Crunch. I'm like, do I live like this all the time? Or like, like you say, you do feel so much better afterwards, even though you're kind of putting yourself through something that's like deliberately difficult, you know?
Yeah. It, the same thing you said before, you put yourself through some kind of struggle to feel better afterwards in a way. I don't know. Some stuff just work this way, I guess.
Self-overcoming is like a big one that a lot of people talk about, right? Where it's like, it's not even beating other people. It's like you can just...
It's you.
You beat yourself yesterday sort of thing, you know? And it's each day is that incremental improvement. Or not, and understanding why and being like, well, I learned something even though I didn't do better. It's like, I guess I need to sleep more. Or like, oh, like eating such and such actually has improved my whatever. And it's like, cool, okay, now I know. And it's like... So I got really into like Zen texts for a while, and like a big one that... It was a Western guy saying it, but he was like, treat the body and mind as a laboratory. Like, it's the ultimate science kit, because you can just try things and see what happens. Like, why not try meditating every day? Why not try going to the gym or, like, focusing on a single point in space for an hour and see what happens? Like, you have the body, like, it will do something. Like, try it. And that's, like, something I've never stopped thinking about as, like, a good phrase. The body's a laboratory is, like, a big one, definitely.
And have you been experienced with it? Can you share any maybe weird experiences you might have had with your body and mind to explore those things?
In terms of like the recent stuff, there's nothing like big that I'd point to beyond the like, let's say that kind of like that one day of total absorption in every task. I mean, I suppose like, just because it came into frame on the video, the tattoo was like, because this is quite new. This is maybe a little over a year, this one. Thank you. That was like very interesting because I got the whole outer sleeve done at once. So it was like 4 hours for my first tattoo, which was a big experience because you kind of, the pain, it kind of fades away in some ways. It kind of becomes this like, you get so overwhelmed with it that you kind of stop being within it. It's very odd, but I definitely like think it's like an interesting experience to go through. You also get,
I want to do it, but I did. Yeah,
scary. It's a lot of money. I mean, the pain isn't too bad. Like it's
and the money too. It's a thing. Yeah,
the money's the big one. Yeah. And the as soon as you get your first tattoo, you're immediately like, oh man, I can't wait for my next one, which is a problem when they take a lot of time and money. But yeah, that was another one where I've been thinking about it for years. I was like, just do it. Like, what are you waiting for? There's not going to be a better time. Just go and do it. You know, you can afford to do it right now, so do it. So I did. Which is great. And the wife liked it, which is always important.
Oh yeah, for sure. And that's also one thing I like about the exercise is that the wife started noticing and enjoying, and it's great.
That's nice. Yeah, it's not a bad thing at all. I'm trying to give less like deliberate, but like when I was like a dumb teenager, salvia used to be legal in the UK, which is this like extremely hardcore hallucinogenic. That's like, it's not fun. Like for a lot of people, it's like a terrible time. But it was briefly legal in the UK for some reason, or like they just never got around to banning it until after. So my friend picked that up, and that was a very interesting experience that I don't know if I like thought about it deeply at the time, but it's like definitely an image that's like quite stuck in my mind, where my So we were sat in my friend's front room, and like one of my friend's faces turned into like a porcelain mask. So like the outside was like porcelain, and like the mm-hmm. edges were all painted in like a kind of red paint. And then it got very odd when, so I saw like the room, it was being carried by a big blue flaming hand, and there was like an infinity of these on a black background, and they were kind of like zooming past your vision. Wow. That was a lot, and it's like very short and very intense, but it's the weird thing with it is you're aware or at least I was aware on some level that this was like the imagination. Like I could still yeah. tell what was like visual input and what was being invented and kind of elaborated on top of that. But the plasticity between them, like being like, oh, I'm purely imagining this thing, but it's like it's so vivid that it almost like overrides what the eyes are seeing, or like blends mm-hmm. with it so seamlessly despite knowing that. It was very interesting realizing like you are kind of like a perception filter as like a person. Like,
oh, yeah.
You're not seeing
we're
an objective.
You're not seeing reality, no.
Yeah,
no.
For sure. And that was like we a big not. One, I think. Yeah. When I first encountered the idea, like then I thought back to that experience and was like, oh no, yeah, okay, cool, no questions here, like totally. Which is like a big one, I think, like in terms of changing how you think about things and see things.
Yeah,
but yeah, not so much at the time because we were like 15 or something. Like we weren't thinking that big yeah. at that time. We just thought,
oh yeah.
Yeah.
Have you ever tried any other psychedelics after that? Like when you got a little bit older?
I've not really had the opportunity.
I never tried when I was younger because I was afraid and it was super boring, all those kind of stuff. But I tried recently, and that's kind of reflections and things you see and helps you, and at least me helped me think about stuff in a different way and have some realizations and understanding about stuff that happened to me and continue to happen. And I don't know. I heard about salvia. Yeah.
Definitely. I think it's great for like done in the right way with the right intention with the
yeah.
right people. I think it's so good.
That's
it's,
the point.
It's purely an access thing, like over here more than anything else. Not a lack of willingness.
Yeah. And talking a little bit more about now spirituality and religion and maybe philosophy. We talk a little bit about this, mindfulness and Zen. Do you have any kind of religion or spirituality or even, a philosophy that helps you navigate life in general, helps you deal with difficult situations and, think through hard times? Anything like this for you?
So my family on my dad's side was raised Catholic, whereas my mum's side is almost like anti-clerical, I did like Sunday school a bit at school, but I think between that and going to a specifically like Church of England primary school, is a great combination for making sure that you don't want anything to do with the Christian church, because like unless you've already bought in, it feels very pervasive in like a kind of negative way. So sort of as a younger person, like a kind of teenager, quite like a hard atheist for a long time, whereas now I've definitely softened into a kind of agnosticism, I would say. Like if there is or isn't, it's kind of unknowable. And I think like a lot of that stems from like a lot of my ideas around like I don't think there is a knowable truth as such. There's just what we are here now and kind of what we perceive, and like we do get quite a lot of say in that. Like there's people who believe that their belief shapes reality, and like hey, for them it probably does, like it's
yeah,
clearly
it
having some sort
them.
Of impact. Yeah. And it's like you kind of is it like Robert Anton Wilson talks about like reality tunnels and stuff, where like people can kind of build a tunnel of like how they believe reality works, and like because they're burrowing through reality in their tunnel, they only see yeah. the stuff in their tunnel. And he also had the idea of like pan agnosticism as well, like kind of a bit of like skeptical towards everything, which is like but not in a skeptical towards everything but also willing to be credulous towards anything, which is like an interesting like kind of dichotomy where it's like I don't know if that's true, but I don't know if it's not true either, and kind of like an openness to ideas, which I think is like
curious
very valid,
in
like,
kind
I
of
think,
way, right? You don't believe it's real, but you're curious to see and kind of excited to be proven wrong in a way, right? Like, I don't believe in the supernatural, but I would love to see it and be proven wrong in a way, right?
Yeah, no, for sure. Absolutely. I mean, like, with a lot of things, right, where it is just kind of like, well, I don't have a reason to think otherwise at the moment, but there is the acknowledgement of like, well, if a lot of people like are thinking something, there's clearly like something that works here, and that's always interesting. Like the kind of going back to like the interest in history, there's like the plasticity of human beings. Like, we've been so many different things over so many thousands of years. Like, the worldview of like a Roman soldier is like incomprehensible to like us right now in a lot of ways, but we're both human beings, right? Like, there's some stuff that we would share and understand, but there's also a lot of like beliefs and actions which are like we would now call inhumane, and it's all from the same mind, which is very interesting because it's so infinitely moldable.
And there's a lot in common too, like because of anxiety, I read a bunch about stoicism and stuff, and you know, a lot of the stuff they would write about daily life and how to deal with anxiety and problems and personal things are completely applicable today. Like the same problems about, oh, what they are thinking, what am I supposed to do? I have all these problems, and then, you know, being preoccupied with external things. It all is the same thing in a way, like history repeats itself. We're all the same thing, and our problems that seems big are actually very small and have been happening here for like thousands and thousands of years, and we think too much about ourselves sometimes, and we're not that special in a way, right?
Yeah, well, like, we're just the latest in a very long line, right? And like the Stoicism one's interesting because like I'd read Meditations, and somebody was like, you know, it was an opium addict, and I was like, what? Like, that's a wild thing to find out, because it's very interesting. Like, a lot of these, like you say, the repeated personal troubles, where like, yeah, like the fact we have a common ground with people who've done things that again are like unthinkable today, like in some ways makes them even more unthinkable, where it's like, how, like, what's the essential difference that led you to be able to do that thing? Like, is it many smaller little like nudges in one direction? It's very interesting to like, if you'd been born in a different time and place, like what elements remain essentially true? And it's like, probably not many, if anything, right? Like, so many cultural carrots and sticks which enable behaviors.
Yeah, but even though you're you know, agnostic and haven't, you know, followed a religion, have you taken anything from it, like values or teachings, or you know, the way you act or think and do to others, that you learn and continue to practice, you know, to live your life, your daily life, or even if it's not from religion, where did you learn how to be who you are as a person?
So I think, like, for me, I've been, like, politically speaking, like a lot of my thought and action derives from like my kind of principal belief of that, like you. Like, one of the most powerful, important things is like the ability to like choose and consent to things, and be the primary actor in your own life rather than having like life happen to you. And that's been like a really important thing to me. So that means like trying to always be the person to like empower others to make the choices for themselves rather than like dictating any kind of solutions. That's always been about like, well, what can I do to not impede upon others' choices and like kind of freedom of action,
and assuming so responsibility too, right?
Yeah, like, you know, and it's about choosing to take that stuff on, right? Like, you shouldn't be doing things because someone else has put it on you. You're choosing to take on that responsibility. I think a lot of that came from, I read The Art of Not Being Governed really early on. I think I must have been like 15 or 16, which is by James C. Scott. It's a kind of, as you described, like an anarchist history of upland Southeast Asia or something. And it's fantastic read, but it definitely changed like how I thought about a lot of things, from being like, I mean, all teenagers are like unpleasant. I think I was not like a massively unpleasant one, but I definitely wasn't a pleasant teenager. And that definitely changed a lot how I would like think about things and how I would like want to be in the world. And the idea of, yeah, like you don't have to do things conventionally, but you don't have to be actively against. I mean, I was doing a lot of kind of reading and thinking at the time, but also kind of seeing a lot of people like going to university in the UK is like a thing that a lot of people my age would do, certainly from like my sort of socioeconomic bracket. And like you see a lot of other people and you see them making the choice and see how that plays out. And that was another big one where I was like, okay, like I'm affirmed in my beliefs that I need to be like supporting the people around me to do the things they want to do. Yeah, like it's, I mean, like, you know, the political term for it is anarchism, which is like a big thing. Like I apply in everything. Like I think it's, but very much in the like, you know, supporting individuals way rather than the kind of like no rules way. Like, because I think that's like the like 15-year-old's appreciation for it. It's like, oh, you just don't like rules. And it's like, well, no, it's like, you know, it's about choosing what you want your own rules to be almost.
It's self-organization instead of being organized by others, like it's self-help. It's about community, because people think about anarchism, they think about people just breaking glass and putting things on fire, and it's not really that, you know. It's,
yeah, that's not the point. That's not what people are interested in. It's much more like, oh, a community garden.
Yeah,
you know, like that's the sharing resources, the perfect one. Yeah, sharing resources, like. You know, what's the point of having stuff if you can't use it to help people? Like,
yeah,
you know, it's so yeah. I think for me, that's like, if I do something that doesn't align with my principles, I have the partially useful, partially horrible thing. It's like a physical reaction almost. If like, I feel so bad that it's almost like I'm compelled to do whatever I think the right thing is. Sometimes, like, I remember, I think me and the wife were out in her hometown, and there was a woman who's quite clear, like had too much to drink or something, but she was a mess. So it was like the middle of the day, and they were like, we needed to go catch the bus. I was like, we can't just leave her. I'm gonna go sort this out. So like, you know, we called the paramedics and all the rest of it, and it was fine. But like, even the thought of walking away made me almost feel sick. I was like, I've got to go and do something, man. Like, I can't not. So partially, I guess I also don't get a choice. Like, I kind of almost have to do it. Yeah, it's like, you know, you do it because like you kind of know you have to. Like, it's like, well, what am I gonna do? Not help? And that's like, or like, am I not gonna do the right thing here? Like, of course I'm not. Like, I'm gonna help.
That's awesome. And where did you learn that? How did you learn to be? Because one of the phrases I read recently is that love is an act of service, and what you're doing, it's like you're spreading love. And where did you learn this? Where did you learn to be this helpful and to be preoccupied of the well-being of others and help? Was that an example from the way you were raised? Was that the book that you read?
I couldn't point to a specific kind of instance. I mean, like, I think because my extended family on my dad's side, they all live quite local and everyone's quite nearby. So there's definitely like, it's something they did doing.
Community.
Everyone kind of pitched in. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely. As well as like, we were in, like, my dad was really into like sailing small dinghies, and still is. And like, there were things like, if something needed doing at where the lake was, like, everyone again pitched in. And it's like, whatever you could bring. And my dad, being a landscape gardener, had a lot of the equipment they would need. But everyone would pitch in and help out. And I think, like, that was just so normalized from, like, so early on that it's, like, the idea of it being any other way is kind of weird. And I've just kind of taken that and run with it as, like, a mode of being all the time, not just within a community, but kind of outside of it as well. Where it is just like,
yeah,
why wouldn't you? Like, it's not like you're doing something that's so important that you can't help.
Of course, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's, and it, even like with silly things like chores around the house, it's like, oh, would you mind doing this? It's like, well, yeah, obviously. Like, I'm not doing anything.
Of course.
Like, it's nothing's that important. Like, if you need me to run the Hoover round, I'll run the Hoover round. It's fine. And that's, applying that to big things as well. Like, if my friends need a lift, I'll just give them a lift. It's fine.
Yeah, yeah. I used to have this joke that's saying that giving someone a lift, it's saying I love you, especially with the price of gas nowadays. So it's like, yeah, of course, I would give you a lift. I love you, man. Come on, yeah.
Yeah, no, well, yeah, because it's like, especially if they can't drive or whatever, it's like, yeah, you just, yeah. Can't imagine not doing it.
Yeah. And, you know, look, now we're getting more into the whimsical and kind of silly questions of the podcast, which are more about, you know, getting to know you in a more friendly and fun way. So it's nonsensical questions about, you know, things that don't exist. So, you know, what would you like to if you could dream about anything in the world, like when you go to sleep, what would you like to maybe dream about if you could control your dreams?
Huh. I did try and lucid dream, but I was really bad at the dream journaling part. I would just wake up and be like, I'd like sit there for a minute and be like, it's already gone. It's gone. What would I lucid dream about? It's a tough one because you don't want to...
Do you reasonably remember your dreams? Like, I particularly don't. But
it
do
depends.
You...
If I'm up late on the computer, then no. That's like the big one. But if I'm like up late reading, like usually yes. And I've always like my dreams have always been like very determined by whatever I'm doing at that point. Like when I played a lot more video games as a kid, like my dreams would be in that video game. If I was reading a lot, I'd dream reading the book that I'd been reading before I fell asleep, which is very weird because then I get quite confused the morning afterwards trying to read it. It's like,
oh yeah,
this none of this happened. Wait, and I was like, oh, dream reading. Okay, cool.
I've done that before. Yeah.
Especially
studying for tests, and I start reading, studying while asleep, and it's terrible.
Yeah. Yeah, it's awful. It confuses you so much. It's usually a hint that you're doing that thing too much. I'd be tempted to say I'd probably end up practicing like a skill or something, even though I'd want it to still be restful. But I think I would like. Try and because I've always wanted to be able to do visual art and I've never been able to, and I think a lot of that's like time and patience, but like if you're asleep I'd do that. But also
there's
I don't
people
know
that, like, listen to classes while sleeping to like learn languages, so that maybe could work. I don't know. Yeah,
who knows,
that's a good
right?
idea.
It's yeah, it's just like because I think I'd almost because I like dreams are very interesting as like because we don't really know what's going on with that, like sort of like science has no idea, like occultism has lots of ideas which are very fun and interesting, but science is kind of clueless as to what's going with dreams. So I think it would almost like the fact that it isn't something you can control, I think, is like one of the more valuable things about dreams, where it is like an externalized thing. Where it's kind of presenting like these images to you and you get to think about them, but it doesn't, you can't be like graded on how well you analyzed your own dream or thought about it. Like,
yeah,
it's just whatever you make of it, which like is interesting and valuable. And everything, if you had like, if I had too much control, I think I'd miss that, you know. It's like playing with your dog, like, you know,
too,
you
right?
can win.
Yeah.
Yeah, you want the surprise, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's great. And if you could live in, you know, any fictional setting, world, universe, whatever, and what place would you choose? This can be from games, from fiction, you know, anything. Where would you choose to live, and who would you be there?
It's a tough one, because obviously there's the balance of, like, you want to live somewhere interesting, but a lot of the interesting places are fucking terrifying.
No, it's a fantasy. Like, you can say, "Ah, oh, well, I would be this
would
knight
be
or this wizard."
Yeah, that's
yeah.
true. Yeah, that yeah. is true. I think it's a real tough one. I think like the city of Troika would be pretty fun because that way you kind of allow yourself to do anything.
True.
And just yeah, like running a newspaper in Troika, right? That'd be pretty sick. That'd be pretty dope as like a life.
A tabloid.
Like, you're never gonna
Troika.
Get bored.
Gonna
yeah.
be wild. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. That's the answer. That's a fun one.
Cool. And if you could have any superpower, what superpower would you choose to have? And this can be like superheroes, or it can be like abilities from fantasy creatures or characters or whatever. If you could have this supernatural power, What do you choose? Would you choose to have, and what would be the first thing you would do with that?
That's a real tough one. Because like, there's two like modes here that you can go. You can either go to like sensible ones, like, oh, I'd fly because, you know, imagine the savings of time and everything else. But like, I think super strength is just really funny. Like, you just lift things up just to annoy people. Like, you just pick them up with one hand, and like, they just have to deal with it. You could really get.
Oh, you hold the door with your pinky, and nobody.
Yeah,
why is the door not opening? I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Right, there's like endless stupid stuff you can get up to. Yeah, no, I'll convince myself. Super strength, absolutely. And like, it's just useful. It's like, there's like a thing that
open jars and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Never a problem again getting to your pickles. Yeah, super strength, definitely. That's funny as hell.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. And look, if you could choose any fictional weird thing, from fiction, from games, from movies, whatever, and make that thing real in our world, what would you choose and why? And this can be a faction, NPC, an entity, like a power source, anything, and make it that thing real in our world. What would that be?
Oof, that's a tough one. Oh, man. That is a very tough one. This might be like the cop out, but like, just one of the spaceships from Traveler, man. Like, being able to go between planets and shit. Like, yeah, that's fantastic. Like, everything opens up, even though it's all empty. Like, I think that's still like interesting. Like, I think that's like, I want it to be like a commonplace though, not like super restricted. Like, not just one, you know. Loads of them, so everyone gets one. That's the dream, right? Like, you can get out there, come back, and tell people what you saw. That's like, there's a reason that's like the recurrent fantasy with so many like space games and stuff. It's like, especially more recent ones, it's not just finding stuff, it's like you get to tell people what you found as well. And not like as a brag, just as a like, look at this cool thing that exists. That's kind of like fantastic.
Yeah, I would love to see like in a real super future space exploration happen, and you know, humanity has spread around the universe. But see how the different cultures would kind of evolve from that, like living so separate in different worlds, in different environments, probably with different species and animals or whatever living there. It's going to be...
Yeah, really, it's a big thing that never gets touched in science fiction, like at least games and stuff, because it's really horribly complicated to work out. But like, yeah, the cultural drift where like, you've not seen these people for like thousands of years, and like, you know, how much has culture now changed in 1,000 years, right? Like, almost nothing in common with each other. So definitely big time.
Finally, look, our last question is, do you remember the last time you felt really happy and grateful for being here and being alive? And if you do, can you share with us when was that and what is that you were doing?
Yesterday was just a really nice day. My wife got home from being away from the weekend. I cooked a big curry that took a long time and it came out really well. The weather was really nice for a change because it's been quite grey over here, but the sun was out yesterday when I went for a little walk. Yesterday was just really, really nice. Like, went to bed after reading the book I'm reading at the moment, made some good progress, a really solid day, had a chat with the friends on Discord and whatnot. Not about lots of big things, it's like lots of little things where it doesn't need to be a grand
gesture. About the small things, you know. It's because if you're always waiting for the big things, you know, to be happy and grateful, it can take a while and we forget all the good things, the small good things. I read that there's kind of research that for you to internalize good things, it takes 9 times more time than to internalize bad things, because the bad stuff you have to deal with. So it's the first thing we remember, like what happened today? The first thing we remember is the bad thing you had to deal with, because you had to stop and figure out and, you know, really think about that to solve. But the good thing is it's like an evolution trait, right? Because we had to survive, so we have to pay attention to the bad things so we can deal with them and survive. But now that survivability is kind of a taken, we have this biological thing to concentrate on the bad when we shouldn't. And so this kind of practice of gratitude can be very important for at least for me, my mental health. And
absolutely. When I makes such a difference.
To ask you, if do you have this kind of practice? Do you remind yourself to look for these little things?
I think for me, like, the big one is, like, if something is annoying me or, like, pissing me off, like, I just allow myself to be annoyed and then I move on, like, rather than trying to, like, hold it under control and, like, not show it and, like, allow it to get internalized. Like, if something's annoying, I just kind of, like, go, like, shit, and that's it. Like, it's, I've let it out. It's all gone. So, like, I don't kind of allow like, I just immediately allow myself to be annoyed. And then once I've been annoyed, I've kind of, like, chewed my food, as it were, and it's gone. Like, it's not a problem anymore.
Wow, yeah.
But I should it's just, you know, it's, I've always, been able to just be like, ah, I'm annoyed. Okay, now I'm not. Like, it's because I've been annoyed. Like, if I carry on being annoyed, that'd be silly, and I can't do that, so it's fine.
Yeah.
It is. But having
it's,
a gratitude
it's a training,
practice
would
probably be useful.
Yeah. I realize I'm annoyed, and then I'm shutting down, and I'm being distant. And I'm like, what is that you're doing? Why are you annoyed? It's not going to make you feel better. It's not going to solve the situation. It's not going to make anyone around you feel better because they will feel you distant. So it's really just worse for me, right? So
yeah, exactly.
It's not doing any good. It's actually doing bad. So, yeah. But I have to talk to I have to talk through the process. Like, I realize I'm annoyed. And, you know, it's hard. Wow. It is.
Start again from the beginning sort of thing. Yeah, but yeah. It's just, it's doing it. You know, it's one day at a time, right?
Yeah, it's training. Yeah,
definitely.
Luke, thank you so much for being here. We talked about many interesting topics. I learned a lot. You had a lot to share and to teach. So I'm very, very grateful for that. And do you have maybe any last words for the wonderful weirdos that are listening to us?
Just keep going, you know, just keep being weird, just do your own thing, it's fine. You know, if nobody cares, nobody cares, it's great.
Yeah,
if people
it
are
is.
Interested, they're interested, it's fine.
That's true. Like, we also think everybody is caring and noticing us and thinking about maybe criticizing us, but everybody is really busy with their own stuff, so nobody cares, just do you and be weird.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, the worst thing you could be is boring, right?
And look, can you take us out saying the catchphrase of the show? Keep it weird, everybody.
All right. Keep it weird, everybody. And see you next time.
Thank you for listening to Weird Games and Weirder People. If you'd like to keep up with the show, please subscribe to be notified when we release new episodes. If you'd like to support us, please leave a review or head on to ko-fi.com/WGNWP. See you next time, and remember, weird is the new wonderful.